So I'm going to hit record on that. I'm going to move it to the middle. This will be a part that I cut out. I'll hit record on this just to have it as backup. Okay, so we'll get started. We are sitting here in Tite Library Room 231, and I am Rebecca Floyd, Digital Scholarship Librarian.
I am Jamal Ratchford, Associate Professor of History and REMS, which is Race, Ethnicity, and Migration Studies at Colorado College.
And I'm Stephen Paul, class of 1978, and was the student coach that started the program in 1975. And today is Thursday, October 31st, 2024.
All right. Do you guys want to get started?
Well, we are here today to interview Coach Stephen Paul, who built the legendary Colorado College women's soccer program as a student athlete, was the central leader in organizing competitive soccer opportunities for girls and women in the city, state, and country at a moment without professional leagues for women. He organized the first intercollegiate national championship in 1980, hosted by Colorado College, and was involved in organizing the first organizational national championship for women in 1981 with the Association for Intercollegiate Athletics for Women. So to begin, Coach, can you tell us about your upbringing in Michigan City, Indiana?
Yes, I was... I grew up in Long Beach, which is a subset of Michigan City, Indiana, on Lake Michigan. It was a town of a lot of the steel industry executives that would summer there or live there. It was a great place to grow up. It was, you know, we were given a lot of independence and a lot of freedom to reign, rode our bikes everywhere. It was a small community. And my dad was a family physician. And he strongly believed in good academia, so he set us up for, you know, a private high school because he didn't think the local ones were good enough. Mm. And that's what introduced me to soccer. I was a football player. Actually played football with John Roberts, our Supreme Court Justice.
Oh, wow.
In my little grade school at,
wow.
in Long Beach. And he went to my high school, too, Lalamere. And but anyhow, that's not where we're going with this. I switched from football because I was too small to soccer because it was a renegade sport, and I always have a bit of a renegade in me or a bit of a chip, and that's why this whole story is appropriate, because the chip about the inequity for women's soccer probably started with that. So, you know, there's no real significant high school soccer, so we did have a team. We played the military academies in Northeast Indiana, South Michigan. We played some of the smaller schools that didn't have a football team, so they'd make their basketball team play soccer, so wow. we'd get beaten up by thugs that were 6'6" wow. and things. And it was a wonderful experience. And in my junior, before my junior or senior year in high school, you know, we didn't have a goalie, and I thought, well, I'm going to go to camp and learn how to be a goalie so I can be a goalie if we need it. And I was very fortunate to go to Jerry Yeagley, who was an amazing soccer coach at Indiana University and at that time was national champions many years on. And they had a little camp in Wawasee, Indiana, and they were amazing instructors on technique. And that was the gift that carried forward to when I started doing the soccer thing. But had a very good background on the technical aspect of soccer, because I was never a very good soccer player. I started late. I was one-footed. I was smarter than I was physically talented, so I could see the plays, but I couldn't develop them. And yeah, it was very fun upbringing.
Your mother really instilled a loving spirit, and your father, you mentioned, instilled that work ethic. Can you talk a little bit more about your soccer sort of background in terms of that Yeagley camp between your junior and your senior year in high school, and then how you kind of learned about Colorado College, and how did you learn about this school and your journey to campus? I recall it was quite the adventure.
Oh, it was. Again, I was a renegade, and our school was a preparatory school, and I just remember the headmaster sat me down one year and said, "You're in." And I go, "In where?" And he goes, "Into a private school out east." And I said, "Well, I didn't want to go there." And that started it. And I was like, "Well, I'm not going to just do that." And there was a classmate of mine whose older brother applied to Colorado College and didn't get in. Mm-hmm. And that set the seed, like, well, what's Colorado College? And when my brother, who's older, went to go to school, he wanted to go to Stanford. My dad said, you can't go anywhere west of the Rockies. Mm-hmm. So it met that criteria. And so that junior year was Jimmy Carter years. We were in the gas crisis. A couple buddies, we drove their big old Cadillac, three of us, from Indiana to Colorado solely to look at Colorado College. And, you know, we were driving 50 miles an hour before they did the speed limit because we were smart enough to know that we could save some money on gas. And drove by Armstrong Hall probably 3-4 times, went to the old IBM building twice until we figured out where Colorado College was on Cascade Avenue back then. And, you know, I think I told you this. There's an amazing story about the beauty of Colorado College. The receptionist, and I wish I could remember her name, had a photographic memory. Because I went in and talked to her, and she gave me some literature and said, well, here's what you'll do when you apply next year. And I dropped in like 2 or 3 more times. And every time she looked at me and knew my name. And talk about a salesperson. That impressed me to no end. But, Colorado College had an amazing reputation. And it was out west. It wasn't an East Coast school, but it is the Stanford, of the west. No, they call it the Harvard of the West, right? That's what it was. So it was like I could fulfill my academic endeavors and be a bit of a renegade at the same time. That's the history of coming to CC.
That's great. That's a great story.
You have wonderful luck stories. For me.
Oh, you have immense talent, Coach.
And I think my class was some celebratory of the block plan. I think they were celebrating...
The 50th anniversary of the block plan was last year, right?
Okay, so there was something significant about the block plan, maybe the 10th year they started or something like that when my freshman class, it was a big deal.
What year did you...
I came in at 74.
Okay.
It would have been right around
that
time.
I think it's that, yeah.
Yeah,
right something around like that. I wonder if you can talk about your introduction to the men's team. So you were, I believe, a reserve on the men's team, and your relationship with head coach and fellow institutional legend and Dr. Horace Richardson.
Yeah, Horace, what an amazing man, and his wife Helen too. Yes. Great couple. So naturally I went out for the soccer team, and as I stated, I wasn't that great, but I could play a little bit. I was a good defender by then because I was sturdy. And I rode the bench, enjoyed it, loved it, great group of guys. And then eventually I missed the early session. I was in Europe traveling. I got waylaid there, so I came back late. So I missed the preseason, so I went further down the bench from my sophomore year. So that's when I transitioned full-time from that to the women's coaching thing. But after our freshman year, that's the story that I've never got answered, but there were some of the players' girlfriends who would hang around and kick the ball around and then kind of just play small side games after our practice. And they asked me to coach them in the spring. And that was the beginning of it. And, I referenced the gift from Jerry Yeagley and all about technical soccer, that I could introduce that. And just that started there. But always had a special thing. Horace was always, at times we were competing for field space, but we also had the same vision. We were upgrading the field space and building that out and supporting it fully. And, we would go to Washburn Field, so we wouldn't go on to the soccer field at the time. I think that's what it was called. And so he was an amazing supporter. He saw the value of it, and we've been good friends ever since. And also I had to do a minor here in German, so that fit, but he never was my professor. But, when I came, it was Bill Boddington was still helping the team, and he really started the program for the men. Mm-hmm. And then Horace worked with him, and then Bill passed not too long ago. But what an amazing thing. And the amount, what Horace did for Division III soccer in the West is amazing, and all his international trips and stuff like that. Amazing man.
Yeah, grateful that able to teach the legendary Horace Richardson's book in my Rise of American Sport class, and an amazing amount of stories that are in that book. Before we talk about your involvement in soccer leadership,
there were certain quotes that I remember coming across. Of course, you were framed as, very lovingly framed as, the baby bald eagle, and other quotes like the fly-by-night type of team. And I wonder if you can just talk about some of those early challenges that you faced, that our women faced, using men's jerseys and things, and washing your own kind of jerseys and things like that. I wonder if you kind of walk us through what those early days in 75, I think you still were able to be something like 10-3 or something like that, your very first season in 75, were very successful. So it didn't stop you on the field, but they were immense challenges that you faced. So I was wondering if you can talk about that sort of fly-by-night and what that those early sort of years looked like in terms of women's involvement in sport on a day-to-day sort of level.
Yeah, I'll probably kill the interview here with the duration of things I have to talk about. But yeah, 75, that first season, the first challenge was there weren't that many college programs to play or who would travel. So we played the City League of Tucson. I'm living in Tucson, Arizona. We played the City League of Colorado Springs. We played, you know, some of the schools that had teams back then. So Northern Colorado had one and stuff, but it was lean. And we actually were undefeated that first fall, that first spring. So that was cool. But like you did mention it. So we, I remember I was in Loomis Hall. So I was doing the laundry for our team, doing the jersey washes. You know, we do that every week in Loomis. They didn't charge for that, which was a nice thing back then. But we had to raise all our own money, but we also were kind of really fortunate. So over the years, like our team would, somehow we had a connection with a guy in New York that owned Lender's Bagels. Mm-hmm. So he would ship us boxes of Lender's Bagels basically for free, and we would have bagel sales. Mm-hmm. And we would raise money, and that's how we bought our first set of jerseys. Wow. And, you know, we did our own screening. You know, I did the artwork on all those things. And so we were fundraising as we went. We were politely told that we couldn't raise money, but we did it anyhow. So, you know, I discreetly wrote to all the parents and said, hey, you know, we want to travel. And so they donated, you know, money for us to do that unofficially, which was nice. We had a contact with Brian Sports, which was lacrosse and soccer, and his daughter wanted to come to CC, so we were in communication. She didn't get in. You know, that was the hard part about CC. You have to qualify, right? Yeah. Yeah. But we had a nice link, so he would donate soccer balls for us every year for the tournament. So they were our early tournament sponsor. And I took a forge to Beaverton, Oregon, and met with a soccer coach that I did a camp with, Ken White, who was the soccer, he was the soccer section head for Nike Sports. And we met, and I was pitching to him that they need to have a woman's shoe or, you know, clothing that fit women. And they were sort of it was too premature to do that. Mm. Boy, they missed an opportunity. But they also sponsored us. So they would help us at cost, give us, you know, uniforms or shoes or things like that. So we always sort of just managed to figure out creative ways to get us going. You know, Judy Sonnerman, one of our first student players, wrote a section. I was just reading it, and she was highlighting some of the trips we would take. But yeah, back then, it's like I worked with our head trainer, Bruce Cola, as a student trainer, and so I learned how to be an athletic trainer for us on the road. Wow. I got a commercial license so that we could drive the big school bus, and I would rotate the shift so that we didn't have to bring on another driver. We'd take a big trip and maybe partner with Regis College, the men's team. We took a trip to Utah that way one time. It was affordable. We always just had ways to save some money here and there and just go for the love of the game. And it was really goes back to the women in that time period in the 70s, you know, as Title IX was just starting to blossom, but who had this passion and their excitement for the game, and to, I mean, it's all on their backs, and they showed up every day. It was them, you know. I mean, I was the figurehead, but they were the power behind it all.
I would be honored to learn more about how you're thinking about Title IX in a forthcoming question.
I didn't ask you about your passion for art and passion for geology and as spaces that really intrigued you as a student here at Colorado College. And you did mention some drawings. You kind of snuck that in there, the last answer, very beautifully. So I wonder if you can just talk about a little more about your academic sort of matriculation a little bit at CC. I know you've mentioned to me, and I didn't see myself in high school particularly as a good student. You mentioned not being a feeling that you were a great student. Which is amazing, thinking about your career and your distinguished career in sports medicine afterward, CC. But what role did art sort of play, and what inspired you intellectually here at CC?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the beauty of aging is you can get insight into earlier times. But you know, I see myself now. The stronger things that I do is I'm a visual thinker, so I think visually, I see visually, I can see patterns really well. It drives my wife nuts driving a car, but I can see the traffic patterns, so I speed up and slow down, yes. So I never get stuck. Same thing, I could just see the field of play, and I could just, that was just a really nice gift. But so as a visual thinker, visual person, academics wasn't like my favorite thing, but it came easy to me, except for the mathematics side. I came here as a pre-med student, and I just didn't like the milieu at the time. I much preferred to play soccer and to go to practice and not lab. And, you know, back then I became a Star Trek fan, so I'd watch Star Trek at 4 o'clock or something else. So I struggled with that, and then I finally gave it up. And actually, it was interesting because I was being harassed by the registrar in, like, a later year, like, you have to declare a major. And I just remember plotting out all my classes and all the majors on a grid. And I kind of went through and I said, oh, I'm halfway to art. And that was the art major. And I loved it because it was, you know, I'm also very good with my hands. And so the visual thinker, the hands, you know, problem solving, it was just a really wonderful gift. And then, you know, you do studio art at CC back in the 70s. It was amazing. But you know, you can work with, you know, lathes and tools and a photography studio and do your own prints and stuff. And, you know, now they probably have all the digital things and the laser cutters and all that stuff. But just be able to have all these amazing tools to do architecture and stuff like that was really cool. And then, you know, there was a very famous artist, Cristo, who would wrap things. And I had a very gifted teacher in my last year or two. It was Edwards, and he was a personal friend of Cristo. So I was big on, I did string art, and I strung up the whole El Pomar, no, is it the art center? I strung up all the banisters with string overnight so nobody could catch me. And then it rained, and then it froze, and so all this string had icicles. Wow. And Cristo was in town, and he came with Professor Edwards, and they looked at it, and he just gave me the really nicest compliment. And that was, like, really cool. And actually, I had a commission to do an art thing up in Phoenix, East Phoenix, for their annual summer thing. And we did this huge string art project for them. And it was... So there's just so many gifts that CZ gave to me. I mean, it's just unbelievable for my life development. But you asked about my art. And so that's it.
Love it.
It was just a natural feel. So with soccer, you know, I'd stay late in the gym, and you know, I had keys, so I'd go to the mimeograph room, and then I'd make our brochures, you know, overtime, because we didn't have a budget. They wouldn't have done it if I asked them to. I did our own artwork for our logos and brochures and everything, and it's just a very natural thing.
That's a beautiful response. I think it's a very beautiful layered liberal arts impact and efficacy of liberal arts for our students to such an extent. I know you and I have talked many times. We always talk for about an hour at least when we talk. The ways art has impacted you with medicine, mm-hmm. and how you're thinking about even in retirement with oil painting and glass blowing and sculpture, and just how central art has been and sustained in terms of your life. And perhaps later on we can get to how you're reimagining art at this point.
But, you know, I wanted to say something that I was thinking about just the other day, walking my dog and thinking about coming here for this session and stuff. And the gift of CC, I was thinking, what is the gift of CC? And it's like, The liberal arts, it's the true liberal arts education. But it's amazing here because as a student or anybody, you are supported to do a dream. It could be, I want to do this paper. And it's like, okay, how can we help you? Like, or with the soccer program, there were so many areas. And in my later years in athletics at another university, I see all these roadblocks. But here it was just like, okay, how can we help you? Mm. Not like, no, you can't. Mm. And the only pushback was when we went head-to-head with football because we were on their field and the AD was the football coach. But even then, he was reluctantly helpful. Mm-hmm. And then once Dick Tabor took over, it was like Open Doors and Laura Goldman. But, you know, if you think about it, you're just a student, and they're saying, yes, we'll make you a official club sport. Mm-hmm. Tony Frasca was in charge of all the rec and club sports, and he was like a father to me. He said, yeah, mm-hmm. come in. I'll give you a job. I'll help you do this. And it's just a bastion of opportunity here. And that's the gift of CC, I think. No matter what area you go to, you're supported here. And it's just an amazing university.
We will certainly get back to those. That's actually one of my questions that I have coming up on those supportive administrators. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you mentioned a few of those. In terms of the next one, fairly loquacious, but you were heavily involved in soccer leadership with perhaps at least six athletic spaces from what I've been able to see in terms of archival research. The Colorado Springs Soccer Club, Colorado State Youth Coach, Director of Coaching Clinics for Colorado, Chairperson of All-America, Coach of the Year Selection Committees for the National Soccer Coaches Association, and Chairperson of the Women's Committee, Soccer Committee of that organization. You also were President of the groundbreaking Rocky Mountain Women's Intercollegiate Soccer League. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about your involvement in terms of, you want to call it sports administration, but certainly as a leader in sport from the administrative side, really providing opportunities for girls, for women, through your leadership. I was wondering if you can share a little bit about that.
Wow, I didn't even remember half of those things. Thank you. I think it goes back to some things I've already stated, but one thing I didn't mention is that I'm also a very, I'm organized, you know, I'm very organized in getting things done. You know, like I see the field and then it's like, okay, how do we do this? But a lot of those came from the window and the lens of the rebellious side. It's like, well, why don't we have this for women? So we had a Rocky Mountain Intercollegiate Soccer League for men. It's like, well, why don't we have it for women? Okay, so let's do it. And so it was just like all those things you mentioned, it was like, well, that's the equity envelope for the women's side. And it was just like, why not? And we were just really lucky that doors weren't really shut down. I mean, I remember going to that National Soccer Coaches Association, and you had the legends sitting there, you know, the Yeagleys and the Bob Barr, those guys that played in 1950 team that scored a goal against England or something like that. They're all at one table, and here's all of us young. And unfortunately, back then it was all guys. There just weren't enough women who played that got in the coaching ranks back in the 70s. And we had our little table looking at all these other guys and going, oh, look at how cool they are. Well, that group got cool. But we would just have this camaraderie. We would just brainstorm and we would just say, well, hey, National Soccer Association, where's our women's stuff? And we had the power of a few people that were motivated and dedicated and just got things done. But it was always, I think, from that, the piece of the gift of the women that I was around in those early years, just to push for their opportunity. You know, I was just happy to be the one that was helping.
Do you remember some of those other peers and colleagues that were at that table with you?
Yeah, so, oh man, the names were, you know, and thank you, because you mentioned like Anson Durant would have been there, Bob Scalise at Harvard, mm-hmm. Phil Wright was an amazing guy at Santa Clara University, which was, you know, that's where Brandi Chastain mm-hmm. went to school, and, you know, her legacy. Oh, Ratcliffe in UT, Texas. There was a youth coach that did the Sting that Anson made connection with in Dallas. And I cannot think of his name, but the three of us did the first under-14 girls national soccer camp, and that's where Michelle Akers and Brandy and them were there. I think it was here in Colorado Springs at one of the private schools in the hills or something like that. And I cannot think of that guy's name from Texas, but, you know, there was just a handful, and we were just all, like, you know, in it together, and we're good friends. You know, Scalise, his assistant, and we set a probably the first collegiate national select team that went to play internationally and played in Sweden and stuff. I think it was 1980, and Kristen Fowler was on that team. I think Judy went, Judy Sonderman. But it was really cool because it was all of the all of these college coaching friends, and we just grabbed the best players we could, and we got funding, and we had two teams that played. You know, we started in Amsterdam or outside of that, and then we went to played in Sweden, Malmo. So it was just a great camaraderie. And then, you know, fortunately, we passed it on to the upcoming women who had played and become, you know, in that ranks dominant.
But perhaps we can figure out that Texas connection. Texas A&M, of course, was, and we'll get to this question.
Yeah, he was a club. He was a club, coach. Yeah.
Okay.
And I can picture him, lean, tall, brown hair, and he and Anson would love to mimic, you know, World Cup players, Italy versus England, and they'd horse around after our practices and say, oh, you know, I wasn't good enough, and I didn't have the mental history of the game that they did. But yeah, it was. I'd have to think about that. I just can't remember his name, but
that's
that was a cool camp.
Texas had to have a lot going on. Texas A&M, of course, was one of the seven teams that were involved in that 1980 national championship.
And UT Austin, too. In fact, we had we would have a banquet before our we hosted our own tournament every year. So by the time the 1981 came, we were on our seventh, eighth tournament or something like that. And we all brought everybody to some place for dinner, and there was almost a brawl between UT Austin and Texas A&M. They were doing their cat calls at each other, and they got up from their tables, and some of the other coaches and teams sort of got in between them, but they were going to go to fisticuffs because Giggum versus UT was just like really amazing.
Yeah, and I know they renew on the football field soon, but we'll leave that to Texas to deal with. And of course, I really appreciate you bringing up Judy Sonderman, who was an all-conference player, and Kristen Fowler, one of our first All-Americans, and we had anywhere from 15 to 24 in a decade, which is absolutely amazing, astonishing to think about in and of itself. I'm glad you actually mentioned by 80 we've been doing these banquets, because my next question is actually a perfect segue. I was wondering if you can discuss the origin and any recollections on that groundbreaking CC Invitational, which was really, it seems to me, from my reading, one of the first instances where you were actually organizing local tournaments and bringing in people, schools from all over the place, with leading up to this 1980 tournament. So it wasn't a random thing that 1980 just happened. You were organizing opportunity. So if we can push on that a little bit more, and perhaps through the CC Invitational and anything else that perhaps not thinking about on that build up to 1980.
That's exactly right. It was, you know, there weren't enough teams in our region to sustain a solid league. We had maybe Colorado State, Northern Colorado, Colorado Metro had a team, Washington State, Western State had a team, and once in a while a team would pop up or go away, but that's like less than a handful of teams. So you can't play everybody like three times and have any success. It was just not there. So the tournament was a natural way to bring in other women's teams. So that's how it started. You know, that's how we started the connections that I get to know my peers in other regions. So there was like probably a handful of us that were really impactful in the growth of the women's college game from each region, and that's sort of where it naturally came from. I mentioned Phil Wright out in California. UC Santa Barbara, we used to go there a couple of times for tournament, or just playing on a spring break, but their lineage, they didn't have that dominant coach. They just had a dominant women's team, so the women kept it going. But like at Santa Clara, it was Phil Wright who kept it going, and he would be there through all these different teams. And the same thing with Mr. Ratcliffe at UT. But anyhow, so you just bring these teams in, And suddenly you go, you have now a 10-game season, and half these games are in a tournament play with teams you would never be able to afford to go to. Or, and same with them, they can't afford to go and travel, but you go to one place and play all these other teams. It was wonderful. And that's the beginning of that tournament. And, of course, you know, then we started getting some, self-funding and stuff, but that was the inception point for the first mock national, because then we started thinking, okay, we've really had teams from everywhere in the U.S. except the East Coast and Southeast, and Southeast just didn't have anything then. So we had almost all the regions represented, and Laura Golden, our women's AD, who was huge on the women's, you know, she's going to have a whole section here probably coming up, but she was our women's AD and basketball coach, and she was great friends with Donald Lupiano and all the other big hitters in Title IX. And we would chat, and she was supporting us, and we just talked about this tournament. I said, we have our national, we have our invitational. We could just make a point to get each region. We were AIAW back then, Association of Intercollegiate Athletics for Women. And so they had their eight regions, and I said, we've already got like six of the regions represented with colleagues and stuff, and why can't we just sort of have this thing set up? And so we started going for it, and of course, the western half was easy.
Okay.
And we were getting a little bit of a hard time, and like in Anson Durant's in North Carolina was easy and on board, but we had a really hard time from the Northeast because like Bob Scalise at Harvard, and I think maybe they were two regions, but they were having a hard time committing to coming all the way out here.
Mm-hmm.
And Laura said, let me work on it. And she made calls. And suddenly we had, I think it was Harvard, and then we had, of course, Cortland State and that tremendous video about them coming out here and the challenges they did to get here and, of course, winning the tournament. But so we had seven of the eight regions, well, six of the eight regions represented, and we threw in an extra a Colorado team. Colorado State, I think, took the place of the Northwest because they didn't have a representative, and there was no Southeast. But it was amazing. Other than I think we had a snowy morning, like that was kind of fun and challenging. But
does that Rob Borgeson sound right from Texas A&M?
Yes.
It said that, they found an article about it, and it mentions the snow.
Yes.
5 inches of snow on the ground in Colorado Springs in this article.
Yes.
From a person who was a member of the 1980 squad.
And our weather is like, if it could have been a weekend before, it would have been beautiful and sunny. So
yes.
Who would have known, right? Yeah.
There's an article includes
amazing.
A picture.
But, you know, the amazing thing was all the women were, like, ecstatic to be here, you know, to be in this, like, first. They looked at it as the first national tournament, too.
Wow.
And I mentioned this to you before. I had conversations with Anson, and he was the men's coach at North Carolina as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we were hanging around, and he just stepped off and called his AD and said, hey, we got to talk, blah, blah, blah. And that was the turning point for North Carolina to invest in women's soccer,
wow.
to get scholarships. And he went to Dallas Sting and had the pipeline set up. And that's the dominance that he created. But that was directly related to being in Colorado Springs in 1980. And then, of course, I sent him one of his best players, April Heinrichs, who was withering at Fort Lewis College because she couldn't get into Colorado College.
Wow.
And I called him up and I said, Anson, you got to get this one player.
Wow.
And she's our women's national coach for a couple of years.
She
but
sure was.
And he never gave credit for that story. He says, I found her. And it's like, oh, BS. I handed her to you on a silver platter because she was just withering at Fort Lewis College. It didn't really have much of a team.
Wow.
Yeah.
And on the first 1991 World Cup team, the very first World Cup, April Heinrichs was on that team. Glad you mentioned Laura Golden. We will get to her. Beth Branson, actually, one of your players who ended up becoming the basketball coach, I believe, also spoke at CC, I believe, spoke very highly of you as her coach also at the time. So those connections with basketball and other sports are exciting to hear and welcome hearing more of your thoughts. You actually mentioned Title IX, which was my next question. Thinking about what your thoughts on Title IX and its intersections with women's sport on campus and opportunities for soccer specifically the very first student, I do want to mention her in this interview, that did use our archives to tell the project, and Allie Wakeman, who was a goalkeeper from Syracuse that transferred and played at CC, did a great project and really centered you, and she looked at some of the actually was able to find records on the breakdowns of how many resources were given to soccer, to basketball, to other women's sports on campus, that they believe volleyball, and there might have been a few others as well. And actually broke down through four areas why soccer became the sport. What were some of the challenges? Should we go D2 for all women's sports? What would that do with hockey? How do we navigate these spaces? So anything that you might remember in terms of Title IX, women's soccer, and sort of why women's soccer became the D1 sport would be most appreciated.
Oh, a lot to unpack. So, first of all, as I recall, I never was really raising the Title IX flag, so to speak. The women did that, right? They were their own spokespeople. And all I did was like look at an opportunity and say, why not? And then they would sort of champion it, right? So I never was this person out there yelling at people about Title IX. I mean, I did with Jerry Carley, the AD and the football coach, and because that was probably the most poignant one. But, you know, the other thing is I didn't need to as well, because Laura Golden was just an amazing human being, and she was all over it. And then in terms of how we became that Division I sport, first we became a varsity sport, and which was amazing. I think that was in 78 maybe. But then why we were chosen as the flagship to be, you know, compensatory to hockey as a D1 team here. That was all back channels. And, you know, I wasn't really necessarily the one championing it, but it was behind the scenes. And I know Susan Ashley was on that academic advisory committee, and Laura. And so I think in one of our Zoom calls with the Legends Project, Judy Sonderman gave some insight from Susan Ashley about some of the reasons behind that. I never knew. I had inclinations, and my inclination was that, you know, Laura was the basketball coach, and she already saw that basketball was fairly developed in the Division I world for women's athletics, and it would have been a challenge to try to cut new territory and be excellent right away. It was also a numbers game. You know, what sport has similar numbers that the men's hockey program does? And I think, you know, the writing was on the wall that women's soccer was going to crush it. And they did. You know, look at the first World Cup and multiple World Cups and stuff. And so, because somebody else, I never even thought about this until recently, was like, well, why not softball? I was like, I don't know. Softball wasn't a big thing back then. It is now. You know, 10 years later, it may have been softball. But then also the cost to produce the sport, in my opinion, was always there, because you need a field to play and you need a goal or goals. And then, you know, you need the equipment and stuff, but it's not, you know, just comparing the budget, I think compared to a sport like, you know, that has a lot of equipment like hockey, soccer's pretty much on the cheap. And we always used to advocate that when I did youth coaching and all this other stuff to get people involved. It was like, you don't, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take the biggest person. It doesn't take the smartest person. Anybody can play. Anybody can excel. And anybody can have a team. You just need a ball. And as we know, in underprivileged countries, they just take, you know, they'll wind up a rag of thing, anything, just anything. That's all you need. So a lot of that is speculation. I was not at the table, but not by neglect. It just never needed to be, because Laura Golden was a super great advocate. But we're really lucky, because it's amazing. And I think it was the right choice. If you look back at 30 years or so, I think any other sport, we probably wouldn't have had the same potential legacy and dominance.
I think you made some really good points. One, going back to even that first season, having to share ball or use the men's sort of ball, or the goals, you know, can we just move the goals around to assist with our training and what have you? So absolutely
comes full circle, I think, coming to the next question, that transitory moment to becoming varsity status, 78, 79, becoming, transitioning to varsity status. I'm wondering if you remember anything about that and the buildup. I think we're there now to that. I believe it might have been called, from what I've seen, the United States Women's Soccer National Championships on November 14th through 16th, 1980. So kind of a two-part question of going from that one ball, you know, washing clothes in Loomis Hall, and now you're varsity status and getting ready to host the very first unofficial but official for those that participated national championship for women at the intercollegiate level. So I'm wondering about any sort of insights you have about that, and then I'll ask about administrative support a little bit more after that. But a chance for you to tell our story, to start to tell our story about, of course, Cortland to Colorado is an excellent film and centering SUNY Cortland and the challenges they faced and the beauty of the tournament for them. But here's a chance for us to tell our story, and we'd be honored to hear your thoughts on that build up to 1980 and what you recall behind the scenes of making that happen and the fabric of humility that CC didn't even participate in that tournament. We chose to sit out. So curious on what you would have to say.
Let me deal with that last one first before I forget. So why we didn't participate. So, you know, we tried to fill the regions and we didn't win our region. I think it was Northern Colorado. And then we had to fill a vacancy in the Northwest. And, you know, we easily could have done that as the host school. But we picked Colorado State University, which was second place in our league that year. Oh, God, one season earlier, we would have crushed it. But anyhow, I just felt that we would lend, I can't think of the right word, but a value to the tournament that if we were hosting this for the right reasons to promote the game, to promote a national championship, to get these schools to commit to come from out east, southwest, that if we hosted this and we didn't just place ourselves in there by proxy, it lended a significant amount of credibility to the tournament, and I think it did. And I think that's where Laura Golan got on the phone too and just said, look at what we're doing here, bring a team, you know? And because if we would have just been part of it, it would have been just a bigger invitational tournament for Colorado College, like we've had the eight previous or something. But this already by design was singular and separate. And the intention of everybody coming was, we're representing our region and we're really making a statement here that this is what needs to happen. And I think that was critical in the success of it, besides the fact that it was a successful tournament and people just really had a great time. And then people positioned that to go back home and make better inroads. But also, Laura Golan was involved in the AIW pretty high up and stuff. And they looked at it and they said, well, yeah, we should have a national championship for women's soccer. And so it was natural that they did it the next year, and Laura had me be they had a person in charge of the sport, you know, for the tournament. So I was in charge of the AIAW National Championship, sort of like the formatting, which was hosted by North Carolina. And we, that time, did win the opportunity to go. And it was cool because I was looking at these archives and trying to get more to bring here to donate to the archives at CC, and it was really cool because there were cards from Ken Mayer in North Colorado, CSU and their team. All these people sent us good luck notes, and they all signed it, and they just said, thanks for what you've done. Good luck.
Oh, I love it.
It was really cool.
Oh, that's beautiful. That is so beautiful. We will get back to the AIAW in just a two questions or so, but wanted to have some space to talk about that, you know, those supportive administrators on campus a bit more. You've mentioned Jerry Carl a little bit. I didn't know about Tony Frasca, so that is a new name for me to ask you about, but certainly Richard Tabor and Laura Golan. So I was wondering if to provide a little bit of space to kind of talk about those supportive either faculty and,
yeah,
and learning from some of our legends, that played, it wasn't necessarily widespread in terms of support for women's players on campus at the onset of all of this great stuff we're talking about. So who were some of those supportive people on campus, administrators, faculty, staff, otherwise, that behind the scenes allowed you all to get the support you needed at a moment where you might not have always felt it?
No, that's a good point. And I always believe in transactional things that it's about the relationships, because that will transcend the ask. But so those people that were super important to us, and this is going to be a free-form thing, but on that the list you mentioned, Dean Taylor was an amazing person too, and he was a very big advocate of athletics back then. But yeah, so within athletics, it went back to Emily Varley. She used to do all the laundry for all the teams, and she'd always sort of say, you know, that was one of my student jobs. I'd work with her, but she'd always pull something aside. You know, I played club hockey. She'd give me hockey stuff. And she'd say, hey, you know, I think your girls could use this. And she'd have some older retired laundry stuff that was really helpful, like practice gear and stuff like that. So she's one. Down there in that basement was Bruce Cola, the head athletic trainer. And he had a national persona. He was an amazing, brilliant person. And he actually set me up when I went to Arizona with another champion, Sue Hillman. But he was always sort of this gruff persona, but it was always so that people didn't bother him enough to get his work done, because he was it for all the sports here. But he had a heart of gold, and he fell in love with our program. In fact, that tournament we did to North Carolina, he traveled with us.
Oh, wow.
To that. And that's a huge statement that we made it, that Bruce Cola traveled with us, because he didn't travel with anybody but like hockey and football. And so he was a huge supporter, you know, within the department as well. Laura Golden, I mentioned, obviously, you know, she was amazing. Once Dick Tabor became the AD, he was just a quality being. He was smart about, I mean, he was science smart, but he was just smart about the world. And he directed my future too. But he was a big support. We would just spend time sitting in his office after the building shut down, and we would just talk. And he was super helpful. I mentioned Tony Frasca, who did all the club and rec sports, but, you know, he mentored me and brought me in and helped finance me a little bit and teach me how to do budgets at the university, because, you know, back then it's like, yeah, if you don't use it, you're not going to get it. So make sure you use it, you know, that kind of thing. And who else was significant? Susan Ashley from afar was an amazing supporter of the soccer program and on that athletics council. Trying to think of who else that stands out. Oh, of course, Horst. We talked about Horst, but Horst was brilliant, because in any capacity he could do that wouldn't set his program back, and that's not a negative thing, it's a very smart thing. He was extremely generous promoting us. And you asked about the community soccer and stuff like that, and yes, you know, we had an impact on that, but boy, did he too. You know, we were on his coattails. I'm sort of drawing an end to that kind of, you know, the key supporters there that helped us through it. But
that's beautiful. And Horst, like I said, love that I able to teach his book, and had no idea, like, for example, the one of the South Korean World Cup team from the late 80s came and played against our team, and he has these very brilliant sort of international connections as well, local, regional, and international connections from the performative, but also what he was able to do. I think the Bayern Munich coach came in and gave a training session once with our so he has an amazing story in and of itself. I'm glad you mentioned, now perhaps would be the time to kind of talk about that, the ways in which you parlayed that your central role in organizing the 1980 tournament, to participating in organizing the 1981 Association for Intercollegiate American Women tournament in North Carolina. You did mention sort of Laura Golden. So I was wondering if there's anything more that you sort of remember about your role organizing that tournament, and were there any challenges that you faced in terms of the organizational? How did that all kind of come together from anything that you remember from
April? Yeah, you know, that part's a blur, which tells me it wasn't that hard. You know, I think, you know, I had for the first time ever, like, logistic support. You know, the AIW was behind it, and all I had to do was sort of educate them on the soccer world. And, you know, I had the connections. We started getting regional play then. So it was really, I would just sort of steer them with the expertise about soccer. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall it being that hard because that was, like I said, the first time we ever had logistical support on a true nature. And it was really sort of sweet and sour because we do this and then boom, the next year NCAA just swoops it. And I sort of had a partiality to the AIW because they were standing true to women's sports before Title IX, and they championed it. And then to be swooped, now it's fine because NCAA, you know, has killed it. But it was really kind of bittersweet that time period when we put all that work in and then to have it turned over the next time. But that's the legacy. So I don't recall a ton of the details except, like I said, I think it was, you know, just lending the expertise and other people could screw the bolt on the nut better than I could.
I think that provides actually a lovely capstone to the type of centrality you had and others had in terms of the organizational work, groundwork that you had been doing at that point, approaching closer to 10 years than just getting started. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised to actually hear that type of answer. And it's also a very nice segue, even if difficult to talk about, your final years at CC, getting up to the number 9 ranking in the country, and your exit from CC. I kind of recall, and I remember this as a former coach, which was some of my favorite soccer experiences in my life. Of a full-time job with sort of the part-time pay,
mm-hmm.
and kind of having to think about where your career, your life trajectory fits in that sort of moment and feeling like it's the time to maybe pass things on. So I wonder if you can talk about your final years at CC and that exit from CC.
There's a lot to unpack there, but it's great. I'm welling up with memories. So, and of course, it circles back to conversations with Dick Tabor. But, you know, I was on the pathway for the mid-70s to really push us to be a varsity sport. So I was pushing to be full-time faculty, you know, staff person, like the people I mentioned, you know, Tony and Laura and others. And so I was getting a master's so I could, you know, you had to have a master's degree to be a faculty person in athletics back then. They proposed a couple of academic or whatever positions here. I just remember my first sour taste of academia was my position got blackballed by, I think it was the math department, because the year before they presented got blackballed by another department. It was just like, we're just going to blackball this. And it's like, no logic. And it's like, are you kidding me? And I still think that's true a lot in academia. But so that was the first wake-up call, like, ooh, this may not work. And then the other thing is, I mentioned I did come here pre-med, and I still felt that calling. But at the time, you know, watching my dad was a workaholic and watching that, and I didn't want that lifestyle. And back then, medicine was, you know, house calls, you did your own patients, inpatient. You know, I never saw my dad as a kid, right? So I didn't want that life. And, you know, it's changed since then, but I was on the cusp of that change. And I just remember sitting back and thinking, you know, I don't want to work that hard. And then I thought, well, I have been working that hard. I've been doing soccer 24/7 on a local level, the community level, the state level, even the national level. And like you mentioned, the remuneration, I calculated one time I made 5 cents an hour for my time. I actually did the calculations.
Wow.
And I thought, I'm putting this much time in, but I absolutely love it. And I started thinking, if you go to where you want to be and you enjoy it, the hardship isn't there for the hours. It's your commitment that you love, right? So these are the kind of conversations I was having with Dick Tabor. And I distinctly remember in his office one time, it was probably 79 or something like that, and we were having these heartfelt conversations, and he just looked at me and he goes, Steve, do you know the difference between an advocation and an avocation? And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking I'm smarter than I am. I'm kind of going, no, I think so, Dick, you know, and then I go, well, just tell me. And he goes, one's a job, one's a hobby. And I just looked at him and I said, oh, I think I got a home now and think. And that was the turning point, because that's when I realized that, you know, I'd have these other thought processes of maybe thinking about going back to medicine, and is this going to be forever a hobby or not? And another conversation I had with him, he said, sometimes people get stuck and they look at you for where you are. And his point was, I'm always going to be looked at as a student coach, not a professional person here. So we kind of agreed that a change would be really helpful for the program to go take the next step forward, because, yeah, I could do it, but there were all these sort of implicit biases probably working against us in the program. So all these things kind of came together at a natural point. Mm-hmm. It was very helpful for me. Mm-hmm. And I also understand that, you know, my love of coaching is, like I mentioned, seeing the field, developing players, teaching the game. I don't like sales. And every time I've been in a job of sales, and I did that with the professional soccer team in Denver, I was a sales rep for Southern Arizona. I hated it. Well, soccer was moving to recruitment, sales, basically. And so it was just a natural to be moving out of it at that point when the job description was going to change. And, you know, to get a salary, it needed somebody new. So at that AIAW tournament, our first game, we played South Florida?
Is it Central Florida?
Central Florida, yep. Yes, thank you. And Dane Pibulik was the coach. He was the assistant men's coach. And he scouted us, and he out-coached me to no degree. He took out our two best players, Beth and Judy. Kathy.
Kathy,
what was her last
Ludwig.
Name? Ludwig, yes, thank you. And he out-coached us, took them out of our game, beat us, and we became fast friends. And back then, I told him, hey, I'm thinking of moving on. Do you want to take over Colorado College? So we set that in motion to be to take my place. And so then it was like just natural after that. It's like, okay, I think it was 1980, and we decided to move on and bring Dang in. And Dang just was a gift to this soccer program. You know, he's the professional, smart coach, really good coach, great recruiter. Just set us up for success. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't, you know, if I look back at it, I couldn't have done that because of the barriers I mentioned. Mm-hmm. My personal barriers towards, you know, what the future looked like and within the Colorado College community. Mm-hmm. So it was a natural. And then, of course, I love my next career. Mm-hmm. So it's been great.
I believe your last year was the year I was born, actually. 1982, I believe, was your last year. So we have about four more questions. How do you remember and summarize your record, which was 114 wins, 45 losses, and 8 ties? Full-time work and part-time pay, 5 cents, I think I already mentioned. How do you remember, looking back, summarizing those years?
Well, the first time I did the numbers to try to figure this out for Dave Morose, who was the SID years ago, I was sort of, I can't use that French term, I was not happy with the numbers, because I, in my head, thought we were better than that. And then I read something Judy Sonnerman put together for Susan Ashley and her remembrances of the program, and she would just several times in this document commented on, well, we went here, and I just don't remember who won. And that's it, you know. I had to look up the record for the sake of having a historical perspective. But I always felt we were better than maybe numerically we were. But it didn't matter, because I was so enriched by the people that came through that program. I mean, you know, I was commenting to somebody else. I said, oh, is this a... annual year for you at the homecoming? I said, no. And I don't think I'm going to be going to those anymore. I'm just going to come to the soccer reunions, because that's my year, right? Those wonderful people that I was around from 75 to 82, and some beyond. You know, I've gotten to know some of the huge all-stars with Dang's years, which is a real gift, too, that we're going to revisit, and you'll have in future Legends conversations. But So, you know, time changes history and history changes to what's good. And so that's what I remember it as.
We absolutely look forward to speaking to our legends of our golden generation, who, of course, earned 5 Final Fours and 2 national runner-ups in a span really less than 10 years in terms of when it happened. And, of course, if you look at the numbers, in a, pretty much a decade, somewhere between 15 and 24 All-Americans. So performatively, and I think as you have eloquently shared with us today, from an organizational point of view, we were as central to really the rise of American women's soccer as anywhere else. I think we can make that case because of the work that you and others have done. I wonder if you can just, we're kind of done with the CC part, so we're just going to do a little after CC, if that's okay. Kind of just talking about your life after CC. I know you did sports sociology, and you mentioned Jay Coakley when we've talked before. Sort of medical school. I think you might have even mentioned dental school. And entering the field of sport medicine.
You always have these questions that are like really expansive to unpack. And so I'm going to freeform those answers. Yes, so I did start a master's program, and with the logical thing was sports sociology at UCCS, which was very small back then. But they had a world-renowned sociology department, I found out later. And Jay Coakley was probably one of the most renowned sports sociologists around. So that was a real natural for me, and it was really fun. And boy, they were hard. And that was the introduction to the computer, right? So like, I just remember doing a thesis, I submitted it, and it came back with so much red that I made now my wife help me buy our first Mac, iMac, so that I could do it like, you know, smarter than by hand on a typewriter. And it was really ironic, too, because by the time I finally finished my thesis, I went and I compared the first draft to the last draft. It's almost the same, but they just went through the process. They have to beat you down to get a master's. You know, it's not just like it's easy for you to do the work and be done. So it was a real great learning curve. But, yeah, so that was really fun, and that was really helpful. But it also, having that background has helped me in everything. So I mentioned the art is a real helpful background, but sociology too. I mean, I just, you know, I use it every day. I try to read the room. I try to, you know, find ways to meet people, and then you get things done instead of coming in with an agenda. And that's all, I think, from that background. I can't remember all the other things you asked me. Oh, so my career changed. So I moved from here. I went and talked to the people at CU Med, and they said, hey, you know, we're taking 1 out of 4 applicants, and our tuition's about $45,000 a year. And I'm thinking, boop, A, not going to get in, because I didn't have any of the pre-med stuff, and B, I can't afford it. And then I told them that my dad turned into academic medicine, was in San Antonio, and he said, well, you know, Texas has 8 schools, and they take 1 out of 2. And it's $600 a semester. And I said, see ya. So I moved with Hurricane Alicia landing in Houston. I moved to Austin, Texas, and did all my pre-med, got residency status. I worked, you know, just some gifts in my life. I was doing part-time work in apartment complexes for a big commercial real estate firm. And I'd knock out an apartment over the weekend and turn it over, paint it, fix it, and all this stuff. And then he became, the guy in charge of that was my landlord. And then the guy that was in charge of all the building maintenance for this huge firm had colon cancer. So here I am, a pre-med student, part-time, working part-time for him, and they asked me to run the company for a year or two. And I suddenly made a lot of money, which at the time, Texas went from 600 to 6,000 a year from the oil bust. But it was like all this perfect karma. Wow. So I made enough money to never have to pay a bill for medical school when I finally got into the UT system at Houston. And so was just really fortunate there. So I could always make life decisions based on life and not finances. But yeah, I knew I wanted to go into sports medicine, which in primary care was evolving. It wasn't super, super strong as it is now. Orthopedics is real high on my list because, you know, it's natural for me, visual, hands and stuff, but I didn't want to spend 7 years. I was in my 30s at that point. And sports medicine was 1 year fellowship. and you know, just move in. So my wife and I chose Arizona. She's a midwife, and she did her midwife training on the reservation, and I did my residency at University of Arizona, and I never left. And again, another gift, because I did family medicine, but I was always hanging around. So I walked in the training room my freshman year, my first year in residency, and because Bruce Cola told me to look up Sue Hillman, so I'm knocking on her door, and they're doing physicals, and then I look, and there's Lisa Frazier, who was that player from UC Santa Barbara, who was now our soccer coach. And so I'd volunteer doing physicals, and then I just got my foot in the door, and then I did my fellowship in Phoenix with the Phoenix Suns, and then came back. They held a space for me at Campus Health, and like they say, the rest is history. I just always fell into these wonderful opportunities, and worked with athletics, but, you know, my good friend was in charge, and I left him in charge and just helped him. I was the first fellowship-trained sports physician in Tucson. And so then we started our own fellowship program for primary care docs. And then, you know, with how athletics are, you know, there's a big thing about medical autonomy that you really need the decisions made about a student athlete's health to be made independent of external forces. Now it's NIL, but also like coaches, administrators, and stuff. And so I was lucky that University of Arizona had the foresight to move in that direction. So when just as COVID was hitting, they asked me to take that over. They were actually going to apply for, they were opening the job, but I didn't want it because I was thinking about retirement. But COVID hit, took that over, ran that whole department, got that set up, and that was nice. So it's been really, really fun. And then working with my national organization, we started the in-service training exam for sports medicine. Never had it before, and that's a huge plus for all the people in sports medicine. Even people who I look up to as mentors would write me and said, hey, I read your book in preparation of the test. You know, you have to renew it every 7 or 10 years. And you said, I passed. Thanks. And I'm going, what? You're my mentor and you're thanking me for this thing we did? So it's I've been really lucky throughout the time. So
strongly encourage anyone listening to this interview to Google very closely the legendary career of Coach Paul in sport medicine, because that alone deserves its own interview. Two more, just hopefully much less profound in terms of the details. I remember you sharing with my Block 1 and Rise of American Sport class that you were at the 1999 World Cup. Mm. And how special that moment was for you. That's all right.
It's okay.
It's great. It wakes us up and gets us going. You were at that 1999 World Cup, and it was a special moment for you. Can you take us back to just that moment, that 1999 World Cup? You were in the stands when Brady Chastain made that PK, and you're overwhelmed with emotion.
Yep.
So, hey, coming full circle with everything that we've been talking about today, what would you share just about that sort of moment to see?
I remember that to the day. Yeah, it was. I remember it was hot, so we worked our way up to be sitting behind the press box. It must have been on the west side, so we're as high as you could be, but we're in the shade. And I was sitting with Lisa Frazier, I mentioned, who was from Washington State, played at UC Santa Barbara, and then was the coach at Arizona, and her husband, Bruce Frazier, who was the assistant coach, and we coach a lot of club teams together in Arizona. Jan Smizek, who is probably the premier women's soccer player in the Northwest. And I Googled her, and we had so many parallels. We got her national coaching license underage, and you weren't supposed to have it. I think she's one of the first women to get their A license. Mm-hmm. I got mine when I was 25. Technically, you had to be 26, so I was probably the youngest to ever get one. So we're up there, and we're literally just weeping, watching this game, and then going into PKs, and it's just unbelievable emotion, because, you know, it's the fruition of all those years, you know, and then Jan, who was a youth coach thereafter, was a big influencer in the Northwest. I mentioned, you know, at 14-year-olds, you know, we had touched the likes of Michelle Akers, and I think Julie Foley was at camp, and then to see them win the World Cup, you know, I didn't have a personal relationship with them. They wouldn't remember me from that camp at all, because, you know, but it was just so amazing to see that. And I mean, I remember going back to days when I was here in Colorado Springs, and I'd find, you know, you had to really scramble to find a bar that would have a World Cup game on for the men. And I had boxes of VHS because I would figure out a way to record, and so I record every soccer game. I can't remember how we would get it because they didn't have satellite back then, but, you know, it was crazy, right? And then the women win it the first year. Unbelievable. And to be able to celebrate with these people that, that were really significant.
Final question, and kind of can go wherever you want to go. I just recall you have all kinds of international experiences with soccer, including 2015, I believe, the Under 18 World Cup in Chile. I think you had a role on the sport medicine side there, if I recall. And I was wondering if you can just, if not talk about that one, but just anything sort of that you would like to conclude in terms of your distinguished career and with soccer, and however you want to take that.
Well, it was a gift that gave back, if you think about it, when you talk about international. So like that select team that we traveled with to Europe in 1980, I mean, what a gift. You know, I just, it was just, you know, to be with your, Ken Banda was the coach at UMass.
Yep. Yes.
And I just remember we went to a nightclub in somewhere in the Netherlands, and we went in to celebrate a win at like 10 o'clock, and we walked out at like 4 a.m., and it was still daylight, and we're going, what the heck? You know? And, you know, we had a coaching game, and I split open my eye, and they took me to their ER, and they put glue in it. And I'd never seen that, you know, not stitches, but that was so far ahead of what we did in the U.S. back then. So it's just those opportunities. You mentioned the World Cup Under 18. Yeah, through my professional sports medicine organization, I met Jan Juriak, I think it was, who is the head medical officer of FIFA. And I said, hey, I'm going to Chile. I want to do a research project. Do you know anybody down there in sports medicine? He said, email me. So we did. And then he ended up sending me up to be an observer for the Under 18 FIFA championships that happened to be in Chile. And where we were living, we took a sabbatical for a year. There were two sister cities, and they both hosted. So the person in charge of the sports medicine, it was his first solo year in charge, you know, he's working his way up. So I worked with him hand in hand, and we basically did the whole thing, and I got like the full privileges, as like a full-time. So it was like a bucket list thing, because I didn't want to put the time in over the years to do that, and I didn't want to do it that late in my career, but I had the front row seat to a FIFA event. That was just brilliant, just amazing. And great connections again after that. So it was just all these gifts that came back. So I never looked at it like wasted time, frustrated time. Everything for me was a gift. And just like what you're doing with your projects and with the digital CC thing, it's another gift. And I'm just really thankful to have this opportunity, because it's a great thing to build on, and it'd be great to get those people that actually did the work and played involved in this, but thank you. It's a great opportunity.
Thank you, Coach. Thank you, Rebecca, for
Thank you.
This happen awesome. Today. This concludes our interview.